Well, I have an opening story for you. It's about two young boys, 8 and 10 years old, and these kids were troublemakers. They got into everything. Everybody in the neighborhood was like, oh my God, here they come. And even when they weren't responsible for things happening in the neighborhood, because they were so mischievous, they always got the blame, and the mother was just beside herself. Neighbors were talking. And then she heard that there was a new clergyman in the area who had a way with kids. And so she contacted him and said, could you possibly work with my boys? And he said, sure, but I want to speak to them individually. And he said, I'll take the 8-year-old in the morning, and then I'll take the 10-year-old in the afternoon. So the little boy goes into the church office, and the minister sits in front of him and says, where is God? And the little boy's jaw dropped, and he was dumbfounded. He couldn't say a word. So after a few seconds, the minister said, I asked you, where is God? And still no response from this kid. So the minister got a little bit bolder and started waving a finger and says, tell me, please, where is God? And the kid was so frightened that he jumped out of his chair. He ran home, ran upstairs to his room, and locked himself in the closet. And his brother came home and found him up there and says, what's going on? And the little boy said, man, we are in big trouble. God is missing, and we're taking the blame for it. Our talk today is Jesus the Zealot. Back when I was in ministerial school, I read an article in Unity Magazine that was written by Ellen Devenport, who is really kind of a Unity icon, a published author. And in the article, she was making the point that there should be a sixth Unity principle. Mind your own business. And I read that article, and it just didn't sit well with me. So a couple days later, when I had to give a talk in homiletics, I got up and I told about the article and the point that she was making, and I said, and I could not possibly disagree with her more. And during that 5 minutes when I was giving that talk, I was a zealot. A few years ago, there was a best-selling book called Zealot, but that was written by Reza Aslan. And you may recall that right about that time, our own Rick McKay did a study on this and made a major presentation to those of you who were interested in seeing it. He first presented it to the men's group, and it was so good that I think he made a general presentation on it. But the question is, well, what exactly is a zealot anyway? Or at least in the context of that book. And to understand that, we have to go back and share a little history and culture at the time and what was going on in Judea and the Jewish world. And at that time, there were several Jewish sects that were operative. There were the Pharisees that everybody has heard of. Okay, the Pharisees was both a political and spiritual group. There were the Sadducees that were similar. There were the Gnostics. There was a group called the Essenes, who probably were responsible for providing us with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And all of these groups had their own agenda. They were political, they were religious, some of them were almost monastic, and there probably was some overlapping. And, you know, the Jews probably occupied, you know, membership in one or more of these groups at that time. It might be analogous to what we see in our own country today, in which we have special interest groups that are single-focused on a single cause. A Tea Party. The Tea Party might be an example of what I'm talking about. But all of this was taking place within the Jewish culture. And there is one group that we want to focus on today, and that was a Jewish sect called the Zealots. But again, you need a little background history. To appreciate who and what the Zealots were and what they were trying to do, it's important to remember that the Jews at that time were living under Roman rule. And at the time of Jesus, they had already been living under Roman rule for about 6 or 7 decades. And under Roman rule, the Jews really didn't have it so bad. The Romans respected the Jews as a people and allowed them to practice their religion. There were not centurions posted at every street corner or anything like that. The Jews were free to come and go as they pleased. And in fact, King Herod, who had given himself the title of King of the Jews, was very instrumental in the rebuilding of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And what was significant about this is it lended support to the Jews, it created a spiritual place of worship for them, but it also became a focal center and brought a lot of trade into the area, which allowed the Jews to benefit not just spiritually, but economically from the whole thing. And yet at the same time, there's freedom, and then there's freedom. And all the while this was going on, there was still the cultural thing within the Jewish hearts and minds that they were the chosen people. This was an identity that they had assumed for hundreds and hundreds of years. And while it may be the case that the Romans really allowed the Jews to be on a very long leash, they were still on a leash. And it's like so many other things in life. A lot of the Jewish population really would have been okay with this. You know, I'm getting 3 square meals a day, and I'm sleeping in a warm bed. I can come and go as I please, and it's okay. There would have been others that would have probably have been of a mindset of, yeah, I'm not happy about it. You know, we are the Jews. We should have our own kingdom. And that was the underlying theme, which caused them to yearn for a Messiah. But at the same time, why make waves? And then, of course, there would have been a contingency that just found the whole situation absolutely intolerable, regardless of how kindly they were regarded and treated by the Romans. And this is where the Zealots came in. Because the Zealots really were a representation of that type of an attitude. And the thought of being under political control by some other group just grated against them. And so they were incredibly politically active. In fact, that they were radical. The Zealots were known to be terrorists and assassins, even to the extent that on occasion they were known to kill Jews that they thought were sympathetic or going along too much with what was going on at the hands of the Romans. And in the book that I referenced before, the author really tried to make a case that Jesus was one of a long line of these zealots that had come along in and around the time that Jesus was around. And when Rick made his presentation after doing a lot of research, I think he concluded there really wasn't evidence to support that, and he probably really was not a zealot as classified by being an official member of the sect. I agree with Rick's conclusions. I don't think that this is what Jesus was about. But at the same time, Jesus absolutely, positively, undoubtedly was a zealot. The difference is, I don't subscribe to the notion that he was running around killing Romans and sympathetic Jews. But he was of such an incredible passion, such an incredible steadfastness, that he didn't hesitate to get in the faces of Jewish leaders the high priests and the Pharisees or whatever, and challenge a culture that had been in existence for a very, very long time. And his attack was on the complacency that had settled in and the comfort of living the good life by refusing to fulfill the spirit of the law that was intended when that law was brought together. Jesus was a troublemaker. He never passed up an opportunity. He necessarily didn't go looking for it, like the little boys in my story might have, but he never backed away from it. And confrontation was constantly coming to him as a consequence of what it was that he was teaching and how he was acting and behaving on a daily life. And I mention this because it's not easy being a zealot. Last week, Susan and I were having dinner at home, and we were just talking about how complicated life gets for us sometimes. There is just so much going on. You know, we have our jobs, and we have our family obligations, and we want to try to keep the house reasonably clean. There's preparation for dinner, and all of a sudden something comes at us out of the blue, and we come down with a cold, and it just seems to never stop. And in that conversation with Susan, I had a realization set in for me, and that is that we all want that wave of stuff coming at us to stop, and it's just not going to happen. That's not how life plays out. That's not how it works. The to-do lists never go away. They only get longer. And to then take our attempts to really develop some spiritual growth as one of the components in that package of things that we have to do, it's not going to work. Because as life gets so busy, it's so easy just to say, yeah, you know what, I can't do this today. I can't engage in my prayer work or my meditation work or whatever it might be. It's like when there's a real economic downturn in the country, the first thing to go, the first people that suffer are the charitable organizations because it becomes deprioritized. And so the only thing that makes sense in terms of pursuing your spiritual growth is it has to be the umbrella under which everything else falls. Your spiritual growth can't be one of the things on the to-do list. Your spiritual growth has to be the title that sits on top of your to-do list. So whatever it is that is coming at you, whatever it is that you are forced to deal with, the daily mundane things that are just required, there has to be an ongoing conscious awareness that it's all God. And it sounds really silly, but if you're doing the dishes, you have to have an appreciation that it's all God. It permeates everything that you do. If you've ever been on a diet, and I suspect a few of you may have been, you know, when you first go on that diet, you have this sense of resolve. And then at that moment, whether that lasts for a couple of months, a couple of weeks, a couple of days, or even a couple of hours, in that moment when you have that resolve, you are a zealot. Because you're uncompromising. You're locked in. Your dedication is incredible. And then when you fall off the wagon, you deal with the question, oh my God, is this worth it? Do I really have to climb back on this horse? And it's important to understand and to really appreciate that it really starts off as a discipline. And eventually it becomes a habit. I remember I quit smoking 100 times because it was easy to quit. And I would go through this same thing. And I remember having slowly growing into this mindset of, I'm a smoker, but I'm not having a cigarette now. To a point where all of a sudden you say, you know, I'm not a smoker. It's just not who I am. In the Muslim religion, they have a thing called the jihad. We don't like that word very much because in the Western civilization, a jihad, which is a holy war, has come to be responded to and greeted in terms of something that is really a threat to us. The thought of some other religion, you know, the Muslims coming around and slewing people and killing them because they're infidels. But somebody who is truly a Muslim understands that the single most significant jihad that is ever fought is a deep down internal battle. And really what they are trying to do in that battle is become zealots. As they're trying to rid themselves of everything that is not God, they're trying to rid themselves of absolutely everything that is not Allah. In unity, we really subscribed to that belief that there's just one power, one presence, one source, active in the universe and in our lives. And though, and for the most part, we go through our time, our days, and our routines without even giving that a thought. We have to do what we have to do. And we lose sight of the fact that it is all spirit. We lose sight of the fact that nothing is possible unless it comes to us through the Father, as Jesus said. If we could just start a little bit at a time to take a breath when something happens and just ask the question, where does God fit into what's going on right now? Because I don't see a connection at all. But it's there. And if we could just impose upon ourselves to ask that, how does God fit into this picture? How is this situation, as horrible as it is sometimes, really a blessing? You know, and as we live this incredible gift called life, how do we sweeten it? What's the best way to make the sour taste go away? And if we just shrug our shoulders and say, oh, well, then we've opted not to answer that call that each and every one of us has to be a zealot. I started off sharing that I gave that speech in homiletics class that I so violently disagreed with Ellen Davenport. Because I just had this inner feeling that if you're really, really passionate about your spirituality and your spiritual growth, conflict is absolutely unavoidable. Because the world doesn't want you to change. The world wants you to continue to march to the beat. And so Jesus didn't seek out the Pharisees for confrontation. They came to him in reaction to him living a life that was consistent with the way he was guided by Spirit and by the Father. And so to say that you have to mind your own business and live in a conflict-free world, it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense. At one point when Jesus was confronted by the Pharisees, he stood up and he called them whited sepulchers. That's about as insulting as it could get. He was basically was saying, you know, on the outside, you're beautiful, you're perfect, you're white, you're clean, you're immaculate, but inside you're dead. It's a discipline. But it's a discipline that's so important. If you ever worked out at the gym, it's the same thing as that diet thing. You know, you force yourself because you've made this commitment to get up in the morning and start the day going to the gym. And if you do it for a sustained period of time, that discipline becomes a habit. And all of a sudden, you really can't get to the gym on a given day and you feel dirty all day long. Because something really significant, something that adds to your total being, is missing. To be a zealot, you're called to exercise your God muscle. To be a zealot, you have to embrace, not just in your intellect, but in your heart, that you are the Christ light. You can't light that light. You can't allow that light to really glow and catch fire and share with other people by turning it on and turning it off at different times during the day. It can't be something that you do occasionally. A lot of people like to say, I'm spiritual but not religious. That doesn't work. You can't really be spiritual unless you're religious about it. And I understand that they're talking in reaction to all of the rituals and dogma in church that they don't want to have anything to do with. And that's okay, that's fine. But if you're really about manifesting who and what you are at your core, it involves a very religious participation on your part. The good news is that it works. You don't have to go around as a zealot killing and assassinating anybody and being part of a terror group. The discipline is killing off that consciousness that is old and outdated and that you've been practicing because it's been drummed into you by your country and by your churches and by your families and whatever. And we all have our list of to-dos and not to-dos, our do's and our don'ts. But it's all about killing off and letting go of that awareness so that you could really embrace who and what you are. And so I invite you now, let's take this into prayer and meditation.